This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We are, as a society, leave our corporations to do the work of supplying us pretty unfettered.
When you see an ad sponsored by the chemical industry espousing the wonders of chemicals, you probably roll your eyes like most of us. But how much does it influence our attitude towards chemicals? As consumers, we may do our best to avoid toxins and carcinogens, but they're still everywhere we turn, from our food and clothing to the walls in our houses. This week on Sea Change Radio, we hear from Ken Geiser, whose new book, Chemicals Without Harm, provides a roadmap for sound policing of the chemical industry. By focusing on what we know works, from greener chemicals to greater transparency to the templates provided by regulatory bodies beyond our borders, Geiser lays out a better way to live in our chemical world. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Ken Geiser. He is an author. His new book is Chemicals Without Harm, Policies for a Sustainable World. He's also a professor emeritus at University of Massachusetts at Lowell and a former director of the Massachusetts Toxic Use Reduction Institute. Ken, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Great. Thank you for having me on.
So why don't you give us an idea of how policy informs the chemicals around us? We don't really think of it on the policy end. We usually think of this as a market-based approach. But how can good policy change the way we consume things?
Sure, Alex. Thank you. I will. This country has had a really proud history. During the 1970s, the Federal Congress passed a series of laws that attempted to both regulate chemicals released to the environment, into the air and water, our Clean Air Act, our Clean Water Act, and also policies dealing directly with chemicals as they appear in products. There's a Federal Pesticides Act, there's a Food and Drug Act, there's a Consumer Product Safety Act, and there's an act called the Toxic Substances Control Act. And those four federal statutes, all of them addressed during the 1970s, became the basic structure of federal efforts to regulate chemicals. A lot of that activity ceased by about 1980. And after 1980, the federal government really did not pass any major new federal statutes in this area. What happened after that was a series of state initiatives, but more importantly was initiatives outside the United States, and Europe in particular has been quite active in setting policies around chemicals and chemicals and products.
But we made a lot of progress in the 70s. Where have we backslid, and where has progress been made in your eyes?
Well, we did make a lot of progress. First of all, just getting agencies set up like the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Consumer Product Safety Board, as well as the Federal Food and Drug Control Agency. And these agencies established programs for developing regulations and then standards on exposure on those chemicals. And really use science effectively to try to provide a protective shield, basically, such that the American public would not be significantly exposed to these hazardous chemicals.
So let's dive into some of the chemicals that consumers should be most enraged about that are still very common. What's some of the low-hanging fruit that you would want to see regulated if you were in charge of the EPA or the FDA?
Yeah, there's a group of chemicals that are now a fairly high public concern. Obviously, chemicals that are known to cause cancer, and there are many chemicals that are still in use in products that are known as well-recognized human carcinogens. An example would be formaldehyde. Formaldehyde is used ubiquitously in personal care products and various kinds of cleaning agents. It's also used in mastics that hold plywood and pressboard together in construction operations. If you may remember, there was a great controversy about the trailers that were used to house the people displaced by Hurricane Katrina last decade, and they turned out to be heavily exposed to formaldehyde from those plywood boards. So formaldehyde would be a good example of a chemical that is still fairly uncontrolled in terms of its use in consumer products. But others are like phthalates, a plasticizer that is used in a lot of sort of soft plastics. It's the material that is in a plastic that allows it to be malleable when you hold it and things. And those phthalates are now recognized as endocrine disruptors and asthmogens and in some cases potential carcinogens as well. So it's chemicals like that that are showing up in the products that we consume in our households and in the workplaces that people work in.
And let's look at how some of the European environmental agencies are approaching some of these chemicals. For example, lead, mercury, cadmium, and brominated flame retardants are now banned in electronic products sold in Europe. Why not the U.S.?
Yeah, what's pretty outstanding is that during the last decade, in 2006, the European Union completely overhauled its chemical control policies and sort of wiped out the original policies, a bunch of them that were very similar to the U.S. policies, but put in place a much more comprehensive system called REACH. And REACH is a policy that is now harmonized throughout all 27 countries of the European Union, and requires that all chemicals be registered, something we don't require in the United States, and that for any registered chemical, a manufacturer or an importer must prepare something called a chemical dossier, which is a report on what is how the chemical behaves in the environment, its health, potential health effects, and all. And then allows the European Union to actually identify a certain number of high-hazard chemicals, significantly high-hazard chemicals, that would require authorization from the government in order to use. Now, that is not a system that is in place in the U.S. either. And lastly, there are now some what are called product directives, and the one you speak of is the one having to do with electronics, and that is a directive that came into place in the early part of the last decade that has phased out the use of heavy metals and brominated flame retardants in electronic products, because that meant that it was very difficult to recycle those products. Now, that standard, known as the Ross standard, has become a global standard, and firms in Asia that manufacture products for Europe do not use those chemicals, and then by default, it means that they also don't use them in products, electronic products exported into the United States. But that's not because of a U.S. regulation; it's really because of European regulation.
On a broader palette, the European approach to risk assessment is guided by two principles, the polluter pays and the precautionary principles, which you lay out in your book. What are they, and how do they differ from the principles guiding American policy, Ken?
The polluter pay principles, we do see some of that in the United States, particularly around the cleanup of hazardous waste sites. But it's more developed in Europe in the sense that really where firms have been seen as violating a standard in regards to release of chemicals into the environment, it's much more likely in Europe that they will pay for the actual pay compensation for the cost of cleaning up, but also for the damage done by those firms. In the U.S., we cite firms, but we don't necessarily penalize them with large fines in the way that they do in Europe. Secondly is this precautionary principle idea, which is it's a science standard as much as anything, and it says basically that it's important to be cautious with regards to highly hazardous chemicals that we're uncertain about, not waiting until there's full scientific proof that a chemical is dangerous before we regulate it or try to reduce its use, but instead use early warning signals as a means that if it looks like it's going to be dangerous, then it is appropriate that it should be substituted. In the U.S., we have a different standard which requires significant proof before the government will act. And so there's long periods in which people are exposed before there's a authority to really regulate the chemical itself. It's just a different approach to the way we think about science.
You radical animal, a spirit oh so kind, a chemical miracle echoes in my mind. You are my eyes and broken sight, you are my ever after, you are this wondrous world's delight, you are my ever after.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author Ken Geiser. His book is Chemicals Without Harm, Policies for a Sustainable World. So Ken, maybe you can share with us some of the insight you gathered as the former director of the Massachusetts Toxic Use Reduction Institute. How does, for lack of a better phrase, the corporatization of America and the influence of companies in the policy and lobbying aspect of our government, how does that affect things on a state-by-state level?
What we see right now is bills in Congress to reform the Toxic Substance Control Act, the act I mentioned earlier. And those bills have been stalled and compromised by the trade associations, the chemical industry in particular. If we do get reform of TSCA, it's probably going to be much more modest than I think the environmental community or the public has desired. With regards to the states, it's sort of interesting, and that is that because there are 50 states, the power of the corporations is often, at least the power of the national associations, is diluted by trying to cover it. In Massachusetts, when we enacted the Massachusetts legislature enacted the Toxic Use Reduction Act in 1989, there was certainly opposition from the business community, but we actually eventually sat down and worked out a bill that really became a model kind of piece of legislation. The way the program works is it both mandates that firms report on the chemicals used in Massachusetts and also develop plans for how they would reduce or eliminate the use of the most hazardous. But it also means that we establish technical assistance divisions like my center at the University of Massachusetts that works with firms to actually do the technical work of trying to find substitutes and keep those businesses vital, but to move them to safer substances. So at the state level, we've been more successful. There's good legislation in Maine and Washington and Oregon, and good legislation in California as well. The new regulations on safe consumer product regulations are an example of that.
This is a can of worms that I'm afraid to even open, but take a Ken Geiser shopping trip for us and walk us down the aisle of a CVS, a Walgreens, or a grocery store. Where might you balk at buying something that an average consumer might not? What do you know that we don't know? What are the chemicals that you really try to avoid?
Well, that's an interesting question because, of course, it's hard for a consumer like me to be able to identify all the chemical ingredients in a product. Some products are required to be labeled under the Federal Hazardous Substances Act. Certain things like antifreeze and solvents are required to be. So in a hardware store, you can find some of the ingredients in a product. You can look at labels to give you some idea if you believe that a label like the Green Seal or something like that gives you some confidence. More useful to me, though, is some of the internet databases like Skin Deep, which is a internet database that you can go on and identify what's in cosmetics, or Good Guide, a group that's based there in San Francisco.
We've had them on a couple times, actually.
Sure. It's a great resource, and I use it quite frequently when I'm thinking about buying a product. But, you know, Alex, it's only so much that a consumer can do. I mean, we aren't going to change the system of chemicals shopper by shopper. We are going to have to push for ways that people can act more as citizens and actually address their retailers and address the institutions in their communities that buy products and get assurances that they are looking for products that have reduced use of some of the most worrisome chemicals.
You know, I smoked a lot of grass, oh Lord, and I popped a lot of pills. But I never did touch nothing that my spirit couldn't kill. You don't care, child, if you live or if you die. God damn the pusher. Yeah, yeah. I said, God damn it. God damn it. Pusher, man.
SeaChange Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu. This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm speaking to author Ken Geiser. His book is Chemicals Without Harm, Policies for a Sustainable World. So Ken, what kind of reaction do you get when you see a chemical company advertising on TV, you know, a life with chemicals, a life without, and it paints a very modern, rosy picture? Do you look at this with a jaundiced eye, or is there some truth to it that without these amazing chemicals, we'd still be using stone tools?
Yeah, what can I say? Don't most American consumers have some skepticism when they hear those kind of claims? I certainly do, and they're not accurate at all. That's what advertising does. It tries to manipulate information to make people buy things without looking very carefully.
So what's the most misleading of these claims that the chemical industry tries to trot out?
Well, I mentioned some of the chemicals of that formaldehyde and phthalates in particular. And one of the things that's happening just recently is the chemical trade associations are putting up internet sites that sort of present information claiming that these things are simply not as safe when properly used. And those words always show up, when properly used. And, you know, if you take a product that made with formaldehyde or something like that, and, quote, if it's properly used, it may be not quite produce the exposures. There is such great use, but those products fall into hands of children. They fall into hands of people who may not know what the exposure possibilities are. And they show up in waste streams. They show up from waste. They end up in the environment. All of those things are not accounted for in those claims.
Can you give us an example of products that can contain formaldehyde?
Well, as I mentioned, plywood. It would be an example. Not all plywoods, but most of them do. Columbia Forest Products, for instance, has a line that does not contain formaldehyde. There's in insulation, in bats insulation used in as an insulation in housing, has formaldehyde in many of the products. There are firms offering, they'll say on the package, formaldehyde free. There are various things like toilet bowl fresheners, which have formaldehyde in them. There's in some cases glues and mastics have formaldehyde. You need to look at the label to actually see what is there, or to go on one of these sites that we just spoke about.
And if it's not a consumable product, if it's not food, you don't necessarily need to see much on the label, except if there's a household cleaner or some kind of warning. When you buy tape, they're not putting the ingredients on there, right?
That's right. The firms only provide the information that they're required to. And there's only a few firms like Seventh Generation and Method and a few of those that actually aggressively label their products with what's on them. But they're pitching their products to a very health-conscious consumer market. So they are really trying to feed that consumer with the information they need. Most products do not.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author Ken Geiser. His book is Chemicals Without Harm, Policies for a Sustainable World. So Ken, we see the chemical industry is basically policing itself more or less these days in the U.S. Can you walk us back to the history of how this came to be?
Well, it's a long history. I mean, we've always, our country has always relied on corporations to do a lot of the work of our society. They provide goods and services. They help us with financing. They do all these various things. And we only have looked to government to regulate them when something has gone wrong with that. Even then, there's often very strong resistance in the food, in the drug area. There was resistance to the regulation of drugs up until the 1930s, when there was a major poisoning of patients in a nursing home, and so the law was passed at that point. It's true around pesticides, that we've only tightened our pesticide regulations when something dramatic happens. Otherwise, we let corporations run the business of business. The only thing that curtails that in the market is competitors who might argue that their product is safer in some way and do that through advertising or through tort action when people are actually heavily harmed by a product and they will take their case to court. But other than that, we are, as a society, leave our corporations to do the work of supplying us pretty unfettered.
it's not all bad news in the chemical industry. You've mentioned how there's these websites like The Good Guide, which are coming out to inform consumers of what they're buying to a level that we've never seen before, especially with the advent of the information age. Where are some of the important innovations coming from in the chemical industry and that make you feel a little more optimistic about the future of the industry?
Yeah, I do. I actually, having read the book, I try to end on a positive note because I think there really is good news. There's a movement that developed about a decade ago amongst chemists called green chemistry. It may sound a little strange to a normal listener, but the idea of developing chemicals with a clear understanding of what the potential hazards would be and reducing those hazards. This movement, which began with just a few leading chemists who argued that chemists should be trained to know something about toxicology and pharmacology and environmental science so that when they do research on new chemistries, they can actually, they're informed by information on the potential hazards, has now grown significantly. And there are green chemistry programs now in many universities around the country. Berkeley, the University of California, Berkeley has a center for green chemistry and is working with the curriculum and all to make sure that young chemists really do know something about the hazards. And we now have, for instance, an annual Green Chemistry Awards program from the EPA to try to encourage this. We have been struggling to get some funding through the Congress so that there's really a pool of funding there. But this is a big area for the development of new chemicals. And there are now a host of new little startup chemical companies around the United States that are trying to create safer and more environmentally sustainable chemicals. So I see, even though we don't see a lot of big change within the major firms, I see new stuff coming on and new initiatives and the development of new professional knowledge about how to make safer chemicals. And that encourages me, and I should encourage all of us, because it's one thing to try to phase out the really dangerous chemicals, but we need to make sure that the things that replace them are going to be safer.
Well, I encourage everyone to get your book, Chemicals Without Harm, author Ken Geiser. Ken, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Gene Ammons, Fog Swamp, Nina Simone, and Fleetwood Mac.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.